so we're going. Perfect. So, stay. You can join us if you want. Do you want to join us?
Am I interrupting?
No, I'm just going to ask some questions.
So it's high tech.
Yeah, it's a little...
It's a little intimidating, she said. You know, I'm like,
oh! Yeah, I know you probably asked, like, answered this a million times in every interview now, but can you just, like, maybe talk a little bit about how you got into BJJ and what kept you coming back class after class?
So I started, I used to work out a lot. I worked at a community center, and I would work out 3-4 times a week, multiple hours each time. And I wasn't in the shape that I wanted to be in. And so that one summer, the movie Ali came out with Will Smith, which was a terrible movie, but I thought boxing looked cool. And then the following year, Michelle Rodriguez came out in the movie Girl Fight. And I was like, this is awesome. Because in the movie, she isn't supposed to be boxing. Her younger brother's boxing, and then she takes an interest in it and then beats everybody up. So I was inspired. So I went in search of a boxing gym. And I ran into an old friend, and he took me to a boxing gym, and I was horrible at boxing. So I boxed for about 2 months, and I kept, I was not very coordinated. I kept hurting my knee. And so after a couple months, he's like, let's try ground wrestling instead. And I was like, what's that? And so he brought me to a Sambo class. And I tried Sambo, but the instructor was Russian. The students were Russian. Very patriarchal. Nobody wanted me to do any techniques. I was allowed to do techniques. I wasn't allowed to have the techniques done to me. So it was very one-sided. And I got fed up. And I had a guy in the class who's Canadian who said, why don't you come with me to my jiu-jitsu class? It's very similar, but the people there will let you train. So I went, and I thought, wow, this is, like, really unusual. And I liked it. And there was one girl in the class. And, I mean, looking back, everybody was terrible. But she was able to pass the guy's guard. And I thought, man, I want to learn how to do that. So I just kept going. Because I wanted to pass the guard. And one day I did. And it was just a really fun way of working out. It took the working out part out. And I was learning, and I was having fun, and I was making new friends. So I just kept it up. And at that time in Vancouver, I was learning under a blue belt, and there weren't a lot of places to learn jiu-jitsu. So of the 3 or 4 places, I would just go to all of them. And I was training 6 days a week, but I was just training at, like, 3 different gyms. But loyalty and team wasn't really a thing then, because you just didn't have enough of it going around, you know? So I stayed at it because I liked fighting.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What was the biggest change in your life when you started practicing jiu-jitsu, whether it was on the mats or, like, off the mats?
That, you know, nobody's asked me this before. I don't think I noticed it, but the people I worked with a lot and my friends noticed it. There's this one guy that I used to work with at the community center who was like in his 40s at the time. And I looked at him kind of like almost like a father figure. And he came up to me one day and he says, you know, Emily, I don't know what you're doing, but something's really different about you. And I said, what's that? And he was like, I don't know. He's like, there's just something different about you. And I said, is it good? And he said, yeah, it's good. He's like, it's definitely good. And he goes, but whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And I don't think I could see it at the time, but I think that the jiu-jitsu was giving me an outlet. And people would probably say that one of my nicknames that my boss calls me is Gumpy. And it's 50% for grumpy, because when I don't get what I want, I'm grumpy. And the other 50% is for gumption. And I would say that earlier on, maybe before jiu-jitsu, and I didn't have an outlet, I had a lot more angst. And I think jiu-jitsu gave me permission to let it out. And so, like I said, I don't think I noticed it as much early on, but I think it gave me a little bit more calm. You know, it gave me a little bit more space to process my anxiety or my anger. And I often tell people now that jiu-jitsu is quite meditative for me, because it filters everything else out in your life, and you can just focus on the one thing. Well, we don't get the opportunity to do that often. And so when you're fighting for your life, you have to only focus on saving your life. And now I think that's probably what I love the most about it. So yeah, that's probably what it did for me.
Yeah, so you're the first female to receive a black belt in Canada, which is amazing. What does it mean for you to hold a black belt, to be a black belt? Like responsibility, or do you feel pressures, or are you really just enjoying being there, just continuing to keep working and working?
Yeah, I think when I got, you know, I've referred to this before, that getting my black belt was a really terrible time in my life. I wasn't in a good place with the team I was training with, and in some ways I felt ashamed. But I did go get my black belt because I had so many peers that were like, you deserve it, you earned it. Just because that person's putting it on your waist doesn't mean that it's their black belt. And back in 2008, there weren't a lot of female black belts. You could count them on one hand, probably. I mean, there probably were more, but you just didn't hear about them. 2007 was the first time Mundials came to North America. So 2008, for me to get my black belt was, you know, we were still fighting in a brown-black division for women. There was no black belt division. There were no, like, the weight classes were still, I think there was like two or three. So when I got my black belt, I saw it as potentially the opportunity to create more space for more women, which is why I got it. Because if I'd stayed a brown belt, I think in some ways I wouldn't have as much of a voice. And this was upon the advice of a lot of black belt male friends who said, look, when you get your black belt, it'll just give you a little bit more freedom to do what you want to do, and you should just go get it. Since then, I would say the black belt, I feel like it represents a license to learn. If the average person takes 10 years to get a black belt, I think that you're spending most of those years figuring the mechanics out, how to use your body, how to manipulate the match. You're doing all the technical growth in jiu-jitsu and learning all of these other sort of moral lessons, if you will. And by the time you get your black belt, now you can play. Now you have language. It's like learning the alphabet. I often use the analogy of white belts sort of learning the alphabet towards black belts being able to write a book, you know? And once you know how to use language, you can make up any story you like. And so I think for me now as a black belt, I feel a lot of freedom in being able to explore everything that jiu-jitsu has to offer. And maybe on a more responsible note, I would say I am dedicated to trying to make the jiu-jitsu space more inclusive for everybody. Because when I started, I don't think people knew what to do with me. I don't think people knew what to do with women. I don't think it was heavily considered. And I just never went away. That's why I'm still here. I've often said, I think black belts of my generation that are females are slightly like psychotic and crazy, because nobody training today would have put up with what we put up with. It was bad. So I think now, like, I feel like a responsibility, because I love it, to make sure that other people who want to start don't have to go through the same things that I did.
Yeah. And I'm going to go off my questions, but something on that point. I love your analogies in class. That was amazing. It made things just...
Yeah, it connects, right?
For me, I love analogies and metaphors.
Yeah.
But when you are coming up in that, and I find the thing I struggle with is the little injuries. Like, every time I go to roll with people, and just like, oh, most people are a bit bigger. So I find, just especially as a white belt, I'm constantly, I don't really know where I'm going most of the time, so I bump into things. How do you like push back against like all those little injuries that collect that make it difficult for you just to keep practicing and keep showing up?
So I do some physical training. As a woman, I think it's very important that you need to be strong in certain positions. I've varied from like Olympic lifting to now I'm working almost with like a rehab trainer, if you will. I have a lot of incorrect movements that my body makes because I've compensated for so long, and it's created dysfunction and pain, and, you know, like, I'm always dealing with a weird hip or my neck or whatever. And so now I'm working with a strangely enough, a female trainer, which I've never had before, and she's helping me correct some of my more specific muscle group movements so that larger muscle groups aren't compensating for the smaller groups not working. That's really important. I get osteopathic work done on me once a week. I have chiropractor. I do a lot of body maintenance that I didn't do when I was younger. Probably because I couldn't afford it. You know, like I'm 38 now, I have a job. It's not like, it's an investment in my body so that I can keep going. So I do all that stuff a lot. I go to there's a Korean sauna spa, and like there's 5 or 6 different rooms where you can heat your body up. There's a cold shower. I do a lot of that kind of stuff, breath work. It's really important to do that. And then when I train in my school, another big thing that I do is I divide our class up when it's live training, not all the time, but I'd say most of the time, into sort of appropriate weight groups. So I'll say everybody under 150, 150 to 185, and then 185 and over. And we do a lot of what you guys call shark bait, or, you know, pass protect sweep submit amongst 20 to 30 pound weight gaps. It allows everybody to have a more realistic sense of jiu-jitsu and not feel that they have to hold back or work too hard. And then we just do general rounds with anybody you like, sparingly. And I think when you train with people that are closer to your size, you're not having to stress yourself as much, right? When I came up, I had to train with anybody that showed up. So it was like 250-pound guy, 195-pound guy, and I was just getting smashed all the time. I'm like, no wonder I have all these injuries. But if you can train smarter, then you should. Yeah.
There's so many lessons that I learned on the mat that apply directly to my life off the mat. Can you share a few of those that you've had over the years?
I think it's an Oprah quote. You have to teach people how to treat you. It's really, especially teaching women and smaller people, you hear a lot of people say, oh, I don't know how to do anything after 4 years of training because I'm always on the bottom getting smashed. I'm like, well, you have to teach people that that's not what you want to do. And so I think it's okay as a small person when you're training with a bigger partner to say, hey, I'm really trying to work on my guard passing. Would you mind training on the bottom so I could work my guard passing? I don't think there's anything wrong with asking, like you're still training, but you're asking them to let you work a different position, right? So taking ownership over your training and then teaching people what you want to do, as opposed to just being on the receiving end of everything, I think is really important. You know, today in the seminar, I talked a lot about, you know, being internally motivated to do things, maintaining a certain quality in what you do, being present. I would also say, like, investing in what you believe in. So there's a lot of times where I've trained with people or I've been in a competition and I didn't get the sweep, or I almost did the takedown, but I didn't. And later on, Tachi or my coach or whatever would come up and say, why didn't you finish that? Like, you almost had it. And I was like, because I felt like I didn't. And they're like, it was right there. And so I think that happens in our lives, right? Like, there's moments where everything is building and then you almost have it, but you're like, I don't think I should, right? And so I've learned that sometimes building that pressure is not really a bad thing. It's not when you should back down, but it's really when you should push through. So just when I feel like giving up on myself, I've told myself to just go for it. You know, and 9 times out of 10, that's always been a positive. I think also investing in loss has been a really big one. I used to have more of a mentality that, like, losing, of course I knew on the outside that, like, it's fine to lose, but, like, to really believe that you need to lose. I wish I had lost more when I was coming up. Like, between white belt and brown belt, I think I lost like 2 or 3 matches, and I competed all the time. There weren't a lot of women to fight against, but I just had my game plan. And when I started losing, I was a brown belt losing to other brown and black belts. And I was like, oh, shit. You know, like, now I feel like I have all these lessons that I'm either late on or that I have to pick up and compensate for. And now that I'm older and wiser and I've been in it for longer, I feel like losing early on is a really healthy lesson. So I tell my students to lose all the time, like in training. You know, like, nobody shows up to a competition to lose, but I'm like, look, the important thing is that you're learning something out of this experience. And unfortunately, winning all the time doesn't really teach you much. It just teaches you that what you're doing is effective, but it's not helping you grow. And people don't see that, right? They just think, oh, but I'm winning, I'm awesome. And if you start winning too early, it really, like, it just kind of limits and inhibits your game if you're not coached the right way. So, like, if all you ever do is a flying armbar, then think about all the other aspects of your game that never get pushed because you're so good at doing this flying armbar. It's great, but why not try something else? Why not build your game, right? And so investment in loss is super important. And I really encourage all of my students to play weaker positions. And I always tell them, you're only as good as your weakest link, right? And when my job as your teacher is, by the time you get your black belt, I don't want you to feel like you have deficiencies. As a blue belt, I don't want you to feel like you have deficiencies, because I've seen it. I've seen people who I call, you know, purple belt black belts, purple belt white belts. Like, as a purple belt, you can do this one thing really well, but everything else sucks. And I don't want that to be the case for you, because it's a hard... If you're a black belt and let's say you have a black belt top game, but you have like a blue belt bottom game, you want to talk about humbling. Like, that's hard to come back from that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I find for me it's just trying to be okay with the discomfort. I feel that a lot in my like life off the mats. You know,
yeah.
Like, I get anxious and I go and try to avoid dealing with that or just sitting with it.
Yeah.
And so with jiu-jitsu, you get stuck inside control or someone mounts you and you have to just breathe and just look for that moment where you can pass, try to pass.
Yeah, everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Pushed, but they're not going to kill you.
Yeah. And it's also, it's everything is temporary.
Yeah.
Right? Like, every win, every loss, every terrible position, it's only temporary. It's not the rest of your life. And people forget that, right? Like, they just think, oh my God, it's the worst thing ever. I'm going to pack it all in. And I'm like, no, it's like 5 minutes of your life, if even. You'll be okay.
In your blog, you're very open about sharing about your break from competing. Now that you're coming back to competing again, how do you prepare yourself for competition, whether it's diet, conditioning, strength training? You talked a little bit about what you do for recovery and helping injuries or prevention of injuries. How do you face the nerves and all those things that come with competing?
So just the tactical stuff, I've been around long enough and competed long enough to know the things you have to do. But I think also from being around and having a lot of experience competing and being around high-level competitors, I've also come to a place in my training where I'm not under anybody anymore. Like, Marcelo is my coach, but I don't train in his school full-time. I train my own people. So there is a sense of, like, liberty in knowing that I know what's good for my body and I can do those things without somebody judging the decisions I'm making for myself. And I think coaches always have the best intentions, most of them, not all of them, but most of them. But nobody knows you better than you. And being 38, having had two kids, and not being 28 or 18, I knew that my body was going to respond differently, and I don't come back as quickly. So I read a book, Dara Torres's book, who was the Olympic silver medalist swimmer, I think at 41. She has a book named called Age is Nothing But a Number. That was a really great book to read. She also has like a short, I think there's like three or four on YouTube, like almost little documentary series on her comeback, what she did. And a big point in her book that came out that was that she had to accept that her body didn't recover the same way. She wasn't going to perform the same way. She needed different things. So higher quality, less volume. And she didn't push herself to do the same things that everybody else did. So if I'm 40 and the room of competitors is 18, I know that I'm not going to train 6 days a week, two times a day, because I can't, my body can't tolerate that. So I changed my tactical routine from understanding my body better. I need more recovery. Drilling and keeping it playful was important for me. And then I would just pick like 2 days where I would train really hard. One day at my school, one day at Marcello's. The rest of the time was more methodical. And also at this point in my game as a black belt, I don't need to pull in like 20 new techniques. I have a pretty good core, and it was like building certain parts of my game. Mentally was the bigger issue. When I stopped competing, I was really burnt out, and I had a lot of psychological issues. When I left, when I stopped competing under Ricardo's, you know, part of that was because I won the Mundials, and I spent the next year and a half losing because I was in a team where the head instructor's wife would pull me in for meetings and tell me I had my head up my ass and my teammates hated me. So it was a terrible time psychologically, and I stopped believing in myself. So for me to go compete again, it was really important that I felt good about who I was. And the last 5 years, I've spent working and sort of learning under Josh Waitzkin. So reading his book, The Art of Learning, and then trying to adopt a lot of the principles in that book, and also understanding that this wasn't about getting a gold medal anymore. This was about feeling sort of validated through the process and feeling like I appreciated all the work that was going into it, and by putting feedback systems into it and fine-tuning my game, like this was something that I hadn't been able to do before. And in some ways, I didn't really care if I won because I was like, I worked really hard and I'm proud of the work that I did. So psychologically, I was really sharp for Masters. Maybe I tell people that was the best I've ever felt in competition. But it was like the, you could say, not at the peak of my career, you know? But now that I tapped into that feeling, I wrote a gigantic blog post about it, and I'm like, now I get it. It's so weird, like almost 20 years into my career, I go, now I get what this is about. It took me this long, you know? And so I'm not competing per se 3 or 4 times a year or every month. I competed in August of last year, and who knows if I'm gonna compete this year or not. But if I do, I feel so much better. Like, I have a much clearer mind about what I'm doing now, and I'm not doing it for anybody else. I'm so grateful that I have the ability to compete at all, and like that's kind of where the motivation generates. Yeah.
You mentioned your blog, the why being like really important. Like,
yeah.
Why do you need to compete? How much time do you have?
Just like 5 minutes.
Okay. Shoot.
We can continue it later too. Yeah.
I stopped right there. I just love asking questions and listening to people talk. I think all I do is listen to podcasts.
We can always like continue if we don't get it done today. Like yeah. We can do it breakfast tomorrow. We could do like a call.
I'm pretty easy. I guess for the last question for today then. I guess I'll ask like a question for all of us white belts. And also actually women. This is hard to pick. We kind of mentioned art school. Let's go to art school. So you went to art school before starting jiu-jitsu. What parallels do you see between what you learned in art school and what you learned in the mats? Just to get it on record.
That's a good question. What parallels do I see? So, I mean, I don't know if this is a parallel thing, but I always knew that I loved being creative, but I really struggled with a medium because, and I also knew that I wanted to make art, if you would, be creative, but I wanted to have tangible outcomes. I never wanted to make art for art's sake. Like, I needed to have purpose. I need to have some reason that was driving everything forward. And when I started training jiu-jitsu, I stopped making art. And on some level, I kind of missed that. But on another level, I feel like I just changed mediums. It's like I went from physical art to performance art. And so jiu-jitsu has allowed me to continue to be creative in a mindful way without producing, per se, like an object. But jiu-jitsu has also solved the other equation, which is that it's become a tangible thing. I'm building my skill set, and I have a school. I have a physical place where I can devote myself and build others and do something with my creativity as opposed to just doing it. So that's been really cool. I love that jiu-jitsu is never static. It evolves. And I think that's really similar to having a creative process and knowing that, you know, the paintings or the sculpture or whatever you're invested in today, your work in 5 years will look very different. And it doesn't mean that it's departed, but it's just, it's a continuous sort of energy, if you will, that kind of flows. Yeah, it's not. And I love that about it. So, and I love that with jiu-jitsu, there is a little bit of, there's hierarchy and order. And I think that that too is similar to a creative process because everybody has a different one. But when an artist knows themselves well, they know what preconditions they need to start producing art. And I think that's similar with jiu-jitsu. Yeah.
Thank you. I can ask you questions.
Yeah. You have really good questions.